And through the credit card application process, I found out that there were $200,000 of student loans on a credit report that I didn't know anything about. And then soon afterward, realized that my mother had taken them out. Later that summer, I learned that she had a gambling addiction and that the money had actually been, you know, funneled into that loss at the casinos.
Hello, and welcome to the Rock Bottom Podcast. I'm here with Kristen Collier. Her new book, What Debt Demands, I have it here, Family Betrayal and Precarity in a Broken System. Kristen, welcome.
I'm so happy to be here.
Let's get right into it. This is an incredibly gripping story, and I'm so fascinated to hear about this experience. Kristen, what was your rock bottom?
Well, there's, you know, I think two rock bottoms that are sort of like siblings of each other. I don't know if I'm allowed to have two related ones.
Sure.
But the first was discovering when I was 22 years old and a few weeks away from college graduation, I had gone to get a credit card to kind of help hold me over while I moved to New York City, where I was going to begin a teaching program. And through the credit card application process, I found out that there were $200,000 of student loans on a credit report that I didn't know anything about. And then soon afterward, realized that my mother had taken them out. So that was a low moment. And the sort of twin one was several years later when my father, who was helping to pay for these fraudulent loans, became very sick and was dying. And I realized that not only was I still shouldering these loans, but I was kind of doing it all on my own.
Oh, gosh. And it's such, I mean, student loans are already a really fraught subject that cause years and years of devastation for people. And here you are, your own mother has taken out fraudulent loans in your name. I mean, what was that like?
Yeah, it was pretty horrifying. I think the immediate aftermath was just trying to understand why, obviously. I think, you know, at the exact moment when I learned that it was my mom, I didn't have a sense of what that would mean for me long term and how, in terms of how I'd have to kind of hold on to these loans, which I can speak a little bit more about later. But I was trying to understand why. And my mom said right away that it was that the family was struggling to keep the house. It was around the time of the Great Recession, and my parents had had some job loss, and they had had some financial hardship that I had tracked a little bit. And so my mom said that they needed the loans to keep the house, and that felt sort of horrible that I was being asked to bear the family's home on my back through the burden of student loans. But then later that summer, I learned that she had a gambling addiction and that the money had actually been, you know, funneled into that loss at the casinos. And so I think I mostly just felt sort of abandoned and then confused. I mean, my family was trying to support my mother with her addiction. And eventually she was incarcerated very briefly, connected to some embezzlement that was a part of the addiction. And so all the family's kind of collective energy was going into supporting her. And I think because I was sort of like a tough kid and like they read me as smart, they were sort of like, you'll be fine and we'll figure it out for you later. And so I felt just sort of overwhelmed and abandoned in the immediate aftermath.
That's so much to carry at such a young age. I mean, you're just 22. You're about to emerge into adulthood. This moment of getting your first credit card had to have felt like a pivotal, you know, adulting moment. And then it all comes crashing down.
Yeah, for sure. I was like, what? Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No. What were you going to say?
I was going to say, yeah, I felt really excited to sort of move into the adult world. And I didn't really have big plans for the credit card, but I was like, I'm going to get some work clothes because I have just been basically wearing like sweatpants to class for 4 years. And I'm going to, you know, get a train card and some things for my apartment. And I didn't anticipate that I would get very much credit, but I thought I would get some. And then, you know, very quickly realized I was not going to get the credit card. And that also I was going to get all this other debt, or already had all this other debt. And so that was a big sort of in the moment transition into a whole different life that I didn't know that I had.
Tell me a little bit more about the gambling addiction part of it. You know, I know that you've written in the past how it took some time to understand that. And understand the type of help that your mom needed. Walk me through that, the journey of learning for you.
I know a little bit about it, though I don't, there's still lots of questions that have not been answered and some of which I haven't asked because it's sort of my mom's own journey that she's going on. But in terms of learning about the gambling addiction, I was in a summer training program at a dorm in Queens, and my aunt called me and just said that my mom had been arrested for workplace embezzlement. And then I think she told me soon after, along with some other relatives, that my mom had struggled with addiction. And gambling addiction is really hard. I mean, I think I write a little bit about it in the book. Casinos are incredibly predatory places, and they are arranging casino space and the sort of games themselves in such a way to keep people on machines as long as possible and extract as much money as possible. And so I think, you know, I think of addiction as a disease, but also as a response to an environment. And in this case, the environment was really trying to harm her. And that was something I learned much later. But in the immediate aftermath, I just felt sort of unsure of what this addiction meant for her. And in terms of her journey, I think she's working really hard to remain in recovery. And we talk a little bit about it here and there, but also I'm trying to give her space to allow her addiction recovery to mean what she wants it to mean for her.
Yeah. And I know that even now with technology and a lot of mobile gambling apps, you know, I'm a big sports fan, and you can't watch a sporting event without seeing a bunch of ads for sports gambling. It just seems everywhere more and more. And I'm sure it's devastating to a lot of people.
For sure. I'm just beginning to kind of do more research into that, those kind of modes of gambling. But I think the sort of gamification of every facet of our life is so horrifying. And it seems like there's corporations and gambling entities are trying to get at our money at every way they can. And I'm not a huge sports person, but I have lots of friends who are. And how horrifying to have something that's so such a rich part of people's lives be now a site where they can lose so much money so quickly over and over again. I mean, I think it's certainly, as everyone's saying, going to change the landscape of sports. Forever.
Yeah. Or things like Poly Market, where you're mm-hmm. gambling on just things that could happen in the world.
Yeah.
We're just gambling on everything.
Yeah. And I think sort of connected to that, it's not gambling, but it is this sort of immediate access to sort of credit, is there's all these apps now kind of buy now, pay later, like Klarna. And so people are, you know, going to get groceries, and sometimes just because they can't afford it, because our whole world is incredibly expensive now, there's all these new modes to take on debt that are really harmful, that come with high interest rates. People are paying off debt with other debt. It just feels like there's so much up against us right now financially.
So tell me a little bit more about the debt piece of it. Back in your story, you have found this deep familial betrayal, but now you're saddled with the reality of $200,000 worth of debt. What was the process like to start coming to terms with that?
It was a total shit show. I think, so just a little bit of background about student debt, just in case viewers don't know about it or don't know as much as I do about it. Student loan debts are protected, meaning unlike other secure debts, like a house or something, they can't be discharged through bankruptcy. That wasn't always the case. There was a time around the time of the Higher Education Act in the 1960s where they were treated like other unsecured debts. And you could just get rid of them through bankruptcy if they were really burdensome in your life. And so there were these pathways, these protections to relief that no longer exist. And so after I learned about the debt, I think, you know, later that summer, after I'd had a little bit of space to kind of figure out, get my hands around the debts a little bit, figure out how many they were. There were 8 debts. And then there were some fraudulent credit cards as well. Figure out who I owed money to. I started making calls to lawyers to ask what was possible for me. Many of the cards, or not the cards, but the debts came with like 10% interest rates. So, you know, one debt that was $40,000 had a 10% interest rate. If I were to pay it all, I'd be paying, you know, over $100,000 for this single debt. And that was just mind-boggling, and I knew right away that was going to be possible. The monthly payments were going to be around $2,000. At the time, I was a public school teacher in New York City, so you can imagine that I wasn't making enough money to pay that back. And so I sought out some advice from lawyers, and they were basically like, we can't really help you unless you want to file criminal charges against your mom. And that was because they understood that these loan companies would need to be forced, basically, to get rid of these debts or to move these debts from my name onto someone else's. They're notoriously predatory. These were all private lenders, very hard to work with and communicate with. And they just weren't going to say, oh, these debts aren't yours. Let's give them to your mom. And so lawyers were like, you have to file charges if you want to get rid of them, basically. And that was not something I wanted to do. I felt like it would destroy our relationship forever. I was really worried about her. She was already caught up in the criminal legal system, and I felt like was really suffering enough. And I just couldn't conceive of a world where I took that route. So I said I wasn't going to do that. And then I asked if what other mechanisms would be available for me to get rid of the debts. And they said bankruptcy is not going to be an option. And so probably your only option is just to try to pay these, to negotiate if you can with the lenders for a lower payment plan and kind of live with these. And given how burdensome the loans were, I felt like, oh, I'm just going to be living with these loans the rest of my life. And so that was what the immediate aftermath looked like. And then the book tells the story of me basically trying all these different pathways to get relief and negotiating with the lenders, and often not negotiating because they wouldn't talk to me. And managing, you know, collection calls and these debts that eventually grew to be almost $400,000 in my late teens.
So if someone listening right now is struggling with debt, what are some of those practices that you've learned in doing this work and that you write about in the book?
Well, it kind of depends on what kind of debt they're dealing with. So the majority of the book is specifically about student loan debt. And it also depends if they're federal loans or private loans. But if people have federal loans, which are the loans that the U.S. government administers to us, they have a lot more protections available to them, although not, in my opinion, nearly enough. And so I think the best course of action, if they're not, is to be enrolled in a payment plan. They can find those through the federal aid website. But that's going to be the surest way to ensure, hopefully, that they're going to eventually receive relief, because most payment plans are structured in such a way that they can get out of the loans after 20, 25 or 30 years. Some of that is changing under Trump, which is probably not surprising. And I'd also recommend just to download the payment history in case something gets lost with the new administration. If they're private lenders, that's a lot more complicated. Private lenders are notoriously bad actors. Some of the debts can be discharged through kind of a complicated mechanism involving the courts. And so I guess what I would say is to try to get a hold of a public defender or an expert in student loans. If they've got really high debt burdens, they might not have to pay all of them back. If they have lower debt burdens, I think probably private lenders are not going to be willing to negotiate very much.
Wow. So there's two different things going on here. There's how do you take care of debt if it's connected to you and there's nothing you can do about it? And then it's how do you take care of fraudulent debt that isn't even your fault or your responsibility? And it strikes me as a really selfless choice that you made to not put additional legal burdens on your mother, but to attempt to help her to pay these debts. How did you navigate that?
I appreciate that. I think it was generous. And I also think it was self-protective in some kind of way too. I mean, I wanted to maintain a relationship with my mom and her family and my father. And not that they wouldn't have supported me if I would have gone a different route. I think they would have tried their best. But I think I had some sense that already this action was going to fracture our family for the rest of our lives, and that to involve the criminal legal system, which I also didn't think was going to do anything meaningful in terms of restoration for her, would fracture us further. So I think there was something self-protective in it too, even though it was also very generous. And the book is also wrestling with what it means to forgive someone. And I don't think that I really land on a clear definition of forgiveness, but something I am repeatedly returning to is, what does it look like to really forgive someone? Is it, you know, forgetting that it happened and moving forward as if it didn't happen, which I think is some people's definition. That's not mine. I don't know that I fully landed on one, and I'm kind of testing out different definitions in the book. But one thing I'm thinking about is, how do we let this thing kind of live beside us for the rest of our lives? And can it be dynamic? Can we talk about it when we need to and kind of set it aside when we don't need to? Can we understand our current circumstances is a response to what happened before without, you know, judgment or anger, which is what I'm trying to do. And so I think, yeah, I spent a lot of my 20s as I was trying to negotiate the debts, also negotiate what a meaningful relationship would look like with my mom, where we both could acknowledge what happened and how harmful it was, but also move into something healthier, which is something that we're really still wrestling with today. As you might imagine, what happened was so enormous and the debt was so present for so long that it's been hard to get to a place that I think we both feel like we want to be at.
Yes, I've read that forgiveness ultimately can mean more to the person choosing to forgive than mm-hmm. the person receiving forgiveness, you know, and that it's about releasing of resentments and kind of something to let yourself move forward. I imagine there must have been so much anger for so many years. I mean, how do you kind of wrestle with the emotional impact of such a big financial betrayal?
That's such a great question. And I think my go-to mode, I don't know if it's because I've been socialized or in a particular kind of way as a woman, or because I like to read a lot, and so I tend to kind of intellectualize stuff instead of feel it kind of at emotional body level. But I think my go-to mode is actually not to really engage with anger. And that's been something I've been having to kind of work on, is to just allow myself to be really mad and to be mad at lots of different people. I think it's really healthy to be mad at my mom sometimes, and especially in my 20s and 30s, to have made space to be mad at my mom, which is something I kind of worked at in therapy, and also to be mad at the lenders too. You know, I there's sort of like twin betrayals at the heart of what happened. There's what my mom did to me, and there's also the lending system, which allowed her to do that. You know, if they had all the right checks in place, they pulled my credit report in order to administer these loans. There was a record of huge amounts of lending in rapid succession, more than I'd ever need to go to school by like 10, you know? And they still kept on giving these loans out. And so that is a systemic failure as well. And I think it's really easy for me to be mad at the lenders, whom I find to be deeply responsible for what happened to me and deeply responsible for so much harm across the U.S. in terms of student loans, and a little harder for me to kind of hold on to anger with my mom, because I know that she has suffered a lot too. Obviously, what she did to me was the worst thing she's done in her whole life, and she has to live with that every day, and that is so much to bear. And so I tend to be really empathetic and in touch with that. But, you know, part of writing this book, I think, is a little bit about revisiting some of these moments in my 20s as an adult with more space in my life, emotional space and sort of like cognitive space, and to work through some of this stuff through the writing process. And so through the writing, I think I did get to revisit some of these moments, not just with heartbreak, but kind of with outrage for my younger self.
Hmm. You know, in addition to the emotional impact, you've written about the actual physical impact that such deep amounts of stress about debt or anything can take on your body. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Debt is really hard on the body. And that's for, I think, two sort of main reasons. One is just the enormous stress that comes with not being able to pay something back. And in most cases, you know, people with living with these unpayable debts have really high stakes. You know, people might lose their homes or their cars, or they might not be able to afford health insurance, or they might not be able to take care of their kid or a loved one in a way they want to. And so the stress, knowing that debt is going to harm them in that kind of way, just erodes at the body, across so many mechanisms. You know, that sort of like fight or flight mode that it propels us into harms the immune system and the gastric system, and just sort of like every system is worn down, and it makes us more susceptible to illness. And so that sort of like slow and constant degradation happens. And that does lead to a higher mortality level for people who are living with debt, which is some of the research I get into in the book. And so there's that. But then there's also the fact that people with these large debt burdens often don't get medical care that they need because they can't afford it. And so then there's all this other round of harm that happens when people aren't seeking out going to the dentist to get a root canal or, you know, going to get their heart checked out. And one of the polls that I cite in here is about older borrowers with debt, many of whom have Parent PLUS loans. Like 40% of them don't go and get the medical care they need because of their debts. And so wow. that, you know, is birthing a whole new host of illnesses or problems that might be mitigated because people can't mitigate them.
You've also written about how there can be generational cycles where there, in addition to the situation with you where it was a fraudulent thing, there might be parents that are taking out loans on behalf of their child or children that are helping their parents with debt that they've been saddled with. I mean, it seems like a really desperate cycle that can propagate for a long time. Tell me a little bit about your research about that.
Yeah, that is really absolutely true. And I think is one of the devastating impacts of student debt that people aren't thinking about a lot. It seems, I can imagine, to people who haven't lived with debt before that it's sort of isolated to one person and then paid off according to the payment plan and then life kind of goes on. And for most people, that's not what's happening. So many people who are going to college, students, are not able to pay for college just with federal student loans. There's borrowing caps on those. And so oftentimes they'll either have to turn to the private market, which are loans that have to be co-signed by parents, or they'll get something called a Parent PLUS loan, which is a federal loan that's in the parent's name, but is borrowed on behalf of the students. And so right there, the debt is already kind of shared with their family. And so it puts stress on both the parents and the kids in those circumstances. And, you know, what I think people often don't think about is other kinds of care that can't be offered when people are paying back these huge amounts of loans. So if a kid is paying off debt until they're, you know, 50 years old, they probably aren't available to help their parents into retirement if they need that kind of support, which traditionally might not have been something that happened. Or if parents are paying off these Parent PLUS loans into retirement, using their Social Security to pay these down, they're not only unable to care for themselves, but they're also maybe unable to care for, you know, grandchildren in the same way that they would have. And so these debts become kind of responsibilities of whole families, and they're not able to care for each other the way that they would have if these debts didn't exist.
Wow. Let's go back to your first person story. When did things start to turn around for you?
It took a while. it wasn't until I met a lawyer who agreed to work with me when I was 30 years old that I felt like there was some kind of light at the end of the tunnel. So all through my 20s, I was hustling to work all these different jobs to help pay for these debts. My father, when he was alive, he was kind of helping to pay for them too. And then soon after he became sick with a terminal illness, I thought I have to find some way around this because my life just isn't sustainable in the way that I'm going. And I did end up meeting a bankruptcy lawyer who was willing to work with me. And we made a plan not to discharge the debts through the bankruptcy process, which is really hard to do. But basically to use bankruptcy as a way to force the lenders to talk to me because they wouldn't. I was calling them and emailing them and faxing them. And my lawyer was trying to get a hold of them and they just weren't responding basically at all to what I was saying. But by declaring bankruptcy, they were forced to do that by the courts. And so that created an opening to begin to talk to them about what had happened. And through that process, we, you know, had got handwriting samples, got my mom to sign an affidavit saying that the debt wasn't mine. And we had all these other avenues that we were able to take to eventually get the debt discharged for my name. But that itself was a pretty long process. But it began in my 30s. And that was, I think, the first time I really felt hope, like there would be something on the other side of it, and that my life wouldn't be indefinitely harmed by these loan payments.
Wow. So the bankruptcy process in this case actually functioned the same way that pressing charges would have to get the lenders to start having a conversation about, hey, these debts are actually fraudulent.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And the benefit of this process was it wasn't a criminal process, it's a civil process. And because of the statute of limitations on when my mom first took out the loans in my name, no one could press criminal charges anyway anymore. So we had kind of entered accidentally into this territory that was going to be safer for her and better for me. And so, yeah, it's sort of wild that there ended up being an ending that spared us both. I mean, she didn't have to go through a criminal conviction, which would have been enormously painful. And then I eventually did get some relief, which was also seems like it wasn't even possible at one point.
Yeah, they're so tied to you, like, as a person, it seems impossible to escape from them. Tell me a little bit about this idea that student loan debt is not something that is able to be declared bankruptcy upon. Do you think that's a fair law?
No, I mean, I think it's incredibly fucked up. People, basically, the way, just to put it a little bluntly. The way that that happened was basically legislators were worried that someone would go, get a degree in law school and then just say, like, I don't want to pay this back anymore. I'm going to declare bankruptcy. Or medical school, they were sort of imagining these future wealthy borrowers who were abusing the system and then trying to get out of paying. And that wasn't really happening. I have some numbers in the book. I think it was something like 1.7% of the people who declared bankruptcy in the 70s were actually like lawyers. I mean, it was such a tiny percentage of people who were even going to be, accessing that kind of relief. But lawmakers were really worried that that would happen. And they created this sort of phantom student that they held up and said, look, we need to legislate against this person. And so all of these bankruptcy codes were, in response to this student that didn't really exist. And ultimately what they ended up doing was protecting the creditor and not just the federal government, but all these private creditors that were already making millions of dollars off of students. They found a way for them to even potentially make more money in the long run. And that was at the expense of students who were really suffering. I mean, the people, it's not easy to declare bankruptcy and, your credit takes a big hit. It's really hard to get housing. There's all these sort of regulations on how you spend and manage money during that process. And people aren't doing it just for fun. So the idea that students were just going to be reckless with that, I think, is really unfair. And I think our government should be protecting students and not, private lenders.
Yeah, let's broaden things a little bit more to the policy aspects. I know that you have a lot of prescriptive how things should be descriptions in your book. What needs to change in our society regarding debt?
I think that the book, I would say, is pretty aspirational in what it asks for rather than detailed in terms of the policy. I think public college should be free. We're an incredibly wealthy country, even though I know people are really worried about the, federal debt levels. Having a more progressive tax and taxing wealthy folks in this country, we absolutely could afford public college, free public college for folks. And so that is sort of the ask that I have in the book. There are, specific sort of starting plans that have been proposed, like the College for All Act by Senator Sanders and Representative Jayapal that is not going to pass. But there are, more specific models of how to make this happen, some of which have some kind of caps on who would get college paid for and who wouldn't, which could be starting points. But ultimately, we should have free college available for everyone. That happens in other wealthy countries in the world, and it could happen here. The other thing that I ask for is debt cancellation. The debt levels are totally out of control. I mean, we have $1.7 trillion of student debt. The defaults and delinquencies on student debt burdens are at an all-time high since the recession. People are really suffering, and so there needs to be debt relief, and it needs to happen now. That is very unlikely to happen under Trump, but it could happen, and it should happen.
That seems like a very clear description of things that need to happen: free public college and debt cancellation. to address, like, if someone is dealing with student debt, or on the other end, potentially about to take out a bunch of loans, what would you advise them?
It's a little tough because I do have some advice, but I think that any advice is sort of limited by this impossible situation we're in, where people who want to go to school should go to school. And for folks who aren't from wealthy families, that probably means they're going to take out some debt. And the hope is that someday they're going to be able to pay that back. And that, unfortunately, just isn't the reality for lots of people. And so I think knowing that going into the borrowing feels like kind of a bleak way to enter college. But some sort of practical things, you know, students, to the degree that they're able to, should borrow federal loans and not borrow private loans. And they should be really clear that private loans are going to come with high interest rates, very few protections. They'll be unlikely to get into payment plans. Some people still need to take out private loans anyway, but to the degree they're able to, they should try to just stay with federal debt. And I think, you know, as they're looking at colleges, consider what they want their life to look like and thinking about the cost of those colleges and what kind of aid those colleges make available, and having as many conversations as they can with the, you know, the financial aid office before they begin. Sometimes a financial aid office will negotiate with you a little bit. I think oftentimes not. And then students living with student debt right now, I think getting, you know, trying to stay as informed as possible. There's a website and organization called protectborrowers.org, and they are sort of experts on student loans and then also all kinds of other debts. And they are publishing, you know, up-to-date information on what's happening as new legislation passes and Supreme Court, you know, rules on various outstanding legislation from the Biden administration. And so I think staying up to date with that, with them. Travis Hornsby is a, he's called like the lending guy, but he's publishing, you know, YouTube videos really regularly on the state of things and what can happen. So I think getting plugged into an organization that you trust, that is giving you regular information on what's happening. It's so opaque to understand what plans to enroll in and what's still available and when you should switch plans when one plan is closed down. No one could ever figure this stuff out on their own. So I think finding one of these orgs is a really great idea. And then I also just would encourage folks to not feel shame about student loans. Those of us who got them, it wasn't because, you know, we wanted to be reckless, but because we wanted to get degrees to like get good jobs and be able to afford our lives. And I think so often people feel such shame about their debt that they're even scared to start asking questions or talking to experts because they feel like they've done something wrong, and they haven't.
Yeah. Wow. You know, I'm struck by this idea of someone that's going to college and maybe is not sure what they're getting into when it comes to debt. You know, you're describing these conversations with the student, you know, financial aid office. What are some misconceptions that people might not know about debt and what it can do to you and what it can, you know, what it means?
That's a really great question. And you know, I don't even know if I've really articulated that to myself, but I think a big misconception is just that the federal government is here to protect you and help you. I mean, I think we all want to believe that. And I think there's certainly representatives who have fought very hard for us as students. But I think, at least, I wasn't thinking a lot about debt when I went to school and I took out some federal loans. You know, there was a small portion of federal loans in addition that I did know about, in addition to all the fraudulent debt. And I just thought, oh, when it comes time, the government's going to get a hold of me. They're going to hook me up with the right payment plan and they're just going to help me figure it out. And if it's hard, hey, that's okay. We'll figure it out. And that's not really what happens. And I don't think it's necessarily because individuals in the system are cruel, but it's so bureaucratic and huge, and there's shifting administration and paperwork is getting lost, and the servicers, which are the people that manage the loans, don't always know what's going on. And through all of that mess, borrowers' needs are really getting lost. And so people sometimes have tried to get on, you know, the right payment plan and have been given bad information, haven't gotten on the plan, and then later thought they were, and then 10 years later realized that nothing that they paid had gone to the right spot. And so now they can't get relief, even though they thought they could. You know,
oh my gosh.
There's been like thousands and thousands of examples of this. And so I would say, yeah, the government, even though we would hope that the education department, the federal government are looking out for us, they aren't. But I think we are looking out for each other as groups of borrowers. And so, yeah, get plugged into as soon as possible some of these organizations. And I think going to the federal aid office at college right away and asking about, when am I going to have to repayment or repay this? And at what interest rate is this set? And what do I need to do as soon as I graduate to make sure that I'm on the right pathway? And if I can't pay it, what happens next? And getting the opportunity to talk to another human being as soon as possible so that you're not graduating into a world where you don't really know what's going on with the loans and you're not able to get a hold of anyone at the education department or the federal student aid website.
Yeah, it seems like it can be a really isolating experience, but you're advocating how to find a sense of community of other people that are working to solve the same problems and get this information and kind of really drive that advocacy forward. I'm curious, how would you speak to someone who maybe doesn't have debt and doesn't really understand what one of their like classmates or friends might be going through? You know, what would you have wanted other people to know kind of in this time in your 20s when maybe you're carrying a lot all by yourself?
That's such a thoughtful question. And I think really apropos, because I spent a lot of my 20s trying to figure out how to tell someone what it felt like to live with debt, you know, especially unpayable debt, not like a mortgage payment that maybe is reasonable, but this huge, enormous burden that was kind of hanging over me all the time. And I found it really difficult to put it into language. And sometimes I would kind of resort to metaphor because I couldn't get there without it. And so I would often explain that it felt like I was being haunted, you know, this debt from, in this case, my mother, but in other borrowers' cases, their past, you know, when they signed these loans to go to school, was following me all throughout my life. And so whenever I went to make, whenever I had a big life transition, that debt was there sort of putting pressure on it. So when I moved into a new romantic relationship, I had to say like, hey, if you end up with me, we might have a shit ton of debt. And that could, you know, really make our lives hard if we have kids or want to buy a home or want to live sort of like a traditional middle class life. That's terrifying. And lots of other borrowers, even without, fraudulent history, have that experience too. I've talked to so many student debtors who've talked about how ashamed they are to go on dates and worried they are that the person is going to find out that they have all this debt and not want to be with them. And so I think being aware of the unique ways that student loans have shaped someone's life is something really helpful to keep in mind. If you have a friend who has loans, that might be something that feels ever present for them, even though you can't see it and might not be hearing about it. And then the other thing I would just say to keep in mind for folks that maybe have a more conservative position on debt cancellation and might be thinking like, hey, I didn't get that benefit. Why are you getting that benefit? Like, let's fight for a world where we're all getting benefits. You know, there's enough to go around. And even if you were someone who didn't have to take out debt and worked your way through college and had the kind of resources where you're not going to benefit from debt cancellation, that shouldn't mean that, you know, someone else doesn't get it.
Yeah. That's a really great sentiment. I'd like to bring things back to your mom. After this bankruptcy process kind of plays out and you're able to separate these fraudulent loans from your own name with the loan companies, where did things end up with your mother? And what's your relationship like today?
So the lenders, I had the possibility to pursue that debt with her and opted not to. I think understanding that, you know, she was a single person and a low-wage worker and was not really going to be able to pay these debts back. And the cost of trying to collect those debts was probably going to be more than they could get back. And so she was spared from those, thankfully. And I think in terms of our relationship today, we're still, you know, fighting to find something that feels really good and healthy and safe and healing for both of us. And so it moves in fits and starts. I will say she's a really wonderful grandmother. I have two kids now. One of the kids I write about in the book. And then I had another kid since then, just this summer. And she's really shown up in wonderful ways to take care of them. And I I'm so thankful that she gets to have kind of a new relationship with them that isn't, doesn't have the sort of like history hanging over it that she's having to negotiate all the time like we are. And we are talking about stuff. You know, she read the book and I think it was really painful for her to see recorded in writing some of the worst moments of her life. And also she's been really supportive of it and is, I think, really proud of me that I wrote it and felt like she learned a lot about my experience through the reading process. And so that to me feels really hopeful.
Yeah. I'm really glad to hear that. On the subject of your kids, what has this experience changed about how you maybe perceive parenting and guiding them through their own journey into adulthood, potentially student loans and all of that?
I've been thinking sort of in micro and macro way, or macro and micro ways about it. I think at like the macro level, which is maybe the, I don't know, maybe more significant in some ways. I just want them to know that I'm working toward a world that is really good for everyone. Not just them, but everyone, that I'm part of my life is fighting for an education system that it works for everyone, not just wealthy kids or middle-class kids or kids with parents with degrees. And so I hope that they will be proud of me, that I want that for everyone and not just them. And then on a micro level, I think, you know, I have some knowledge about the student lending system that I hope will be useful as they apply to college someday. But I also know that we're up against a lot. You know, my husband and I are trying to save to the degree we're able to, but college is so expensive. I mean, people on average to attend a public four-year college are borrowing like $31,000. That's so much money. And so I think, and I'm, you know, I'm a teacher, my husband works in a nonprofit. And so, yeah, we probably won't be able to save enough for them to go to college. And that really enrages me. And so I try to keep focused on the fact that I hope we develop something new before they get there. And yeah, that's what I'm working to do.
You mentioned the idea of being enraged and, you know, you had an expletive outburst earlier. It seems like there's, you know, that you are talking about this with the air of the past and, you know, the kind of like healing nature, but it seems like there's a lot of anger like boiling under the surface. Like what makes you really upset about the system?
I think I just feel a little bit like our government has thrown us to the wolves in the form of this lending system. There was a time in the United States history where when the sort of current funding architecture was developed for our federal education, or sorry, for the higher education system. And so they kind of had a choice. They could have directly funded colleges like the K-12 system, where we just go and it's paid for. And that funding is kind of done through, you know, state and the federal government. And instead, they opted for this tuition-based model where we pay. And the government maybe supports that through loans or like to a much lesser degree grants. And maybe the college negotiates a little bit and takes off tuition. But that particular model has created the current like lending system. And so as education has expanded, as it's gotten more expensive, as more people have wanted to attend, instead of giving more funding to colleges to make it more affordable for us and expanding that, instead they've just expanded the loan program and said, okay, more people want to go. Let's have them take on more debt if they can't afford. And if the federal debt isn't enough, then they can turn to the private market and take on more debt. And so they've done that essentially because it's politically easier to get that kind of stuff passed instead of fighting for something that's much harder and more expansive. And yeah, that makes me enraged. I think we have elected leaders that should protect us, you know, across the board, not just through education, but for healthcare. Obviously, healthcare debt is a huge thing. And healthcare premiums are about ready to spike in the new year, unless something changes. And so there's all these ways that I think that our government should serve us, housing and healthcare and retirement education. And that is just, I think, not happening to the degree that we really deserve it. And that, yeah, that makes me feel crazy.
Yeah, same. I mean, yeah, there's so much that is messed up about the way that our country processes debt and sets up opportunities for young people. You know, it's a lot that can be changed. And I think your book really lays out some great ideas that people can get behind. If people want to, you know, support some of these ideas, what's like a way that they can add their voices to this campaign?
Yeah, I think a couple practical things. Certainly contacting their representatives to, you know, demand debt relief and to ask them kind of where they stand on College for All would be great. I also think getting plugged into the Debt Collective, which is an organization that I work with. You know, you can just Google them and find them. But they are working across the board to get rid of these predatory debts in our lives. So healthcare and housing and utility debt and rental debt. I mean, there's so much of it out there. Student debt. And then they're also working to create a world where we're not having to take out these debts to begin with. And so they have so many different campaigns where they're putting pressure on, you know, government officials. They're working with unions. They're working with borrowers. And so there's all these opportunities where someone can get plugged into the kind of space that they're feeling really passionate about.
Well, Kristen, thank you so much again, everyone. The What Debt Demands, Family Betrayal and Precarity in a Broken System. Kristen, I really appreciate all of the work that you do. And, you know, thank you for telling our listeners this harrowing story. But I feel like there is a sense of action and agency and hope at the end. I'd love to know our final question. What's something that you would say to your younger self?
Oh man, what a great question. I would just say, it's not your fault. Hang in there. It's going to get easier.
Yeah. That's a good sentiment to end on. Well, Kristen, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.